Okay, next up we have Zarina Shakir, who's the LSB chair from Washington, D.C., had been scheduled to present at the same time we have the WPFW station report, but she has to leave for another event. Actually, maybe, I think I told her it would be after Greg. So right after Greg, we're going to take Serena's, and then we're going to have a short break, and then Lonnie's report. So Greg, will you take the floor?
One of the things I wanted to do was to play a piece of music for you. Perhaps we'll get that queued up. I also recently went to the conference for the second year of NSCB, National Federation of Community Broadcasters. Pacifica, as Ursula's reported, had a great presence and at that. Let's just listen to this for a second.
And who is saving grace? Who is saving grace?
That, you might be surprised to know, is our local election supervisor in Houston, Tucker Bradley, from a soon-to-be-released CD. She's a singer and an artist there. You'd be surprised going around this network, the multiple talents of the people. Some people are on the air, some people are behind the scenes. But what we're in the process of doing is rediscovering and discovering all that richness. And as I mentioned earlier, I was at NFCB, and I just want to cover a couple of the highlights. There was a lot of discussion there about digital distribution and intellectual property. These were two of the main themes there. And also the fact that you should know is that the CPB authorization legislation, they've been operating without authorization for over a decade now. So they're in the process of beginning to look at reauthorization, which could change the terms of grants. And one of the possible benefits, if it goes well, is that a lot of the developments of the last several years, the kinds of things we're discussing here in terms of multiple platforms, were never anticipated when they were authorized in, last in 1996. And so we're going to possibly see, perhaps better with the Democratic administration, a reconceptualization of how they distribute their money. That's going to be a two-year process. We're also in the 40th anniversary of the Public Broadcasting Act, and as part of that, the CPB is doing this public awareness initiative where they're talking about promoting the idea of public radio and the importance of it. So they're putting energy and resources behind that. That's not necessarily that we will benefit from financially, but we will benefit from it indirectly, assuming they do a good job with it. Their strategy remains in terms of allocation of money, rural and minority station strategy. We do benefit from that to some extent now. On the other hand, there's a flip side of that because they're putting new money toward rural stations, and to some extent that could affect us negatively. There will be an RFP, request for proposal, in May, which will focus on diversity. We'll look into that when we see the guidelines. And also they discussed digital radio conversion, as you discussed here. 68% of public radio has already received funding for this. We're talking about 250 stations that are already transmitting digital signals, with many more to come online. And also, very significantly, they discussed the decision you heard about this morning from the Royalty Copyright Board. I want to reinforce that if this actually occurs, we have no guarantee from CPB that they can continue to provide the kind of support that they have providing at 100% for us. You heard a report yesterday from the archives. I just want to mention I was down in L.A. for that Adopt-A-Tape party. That was a very significant event. Small number at Allie Willis's house, the composer award-winning composer. He didn't mention some of the people there. You know, some people, names you'd recognize, like the Steve Miller from the Steve Miller Band, Weird Al Yankovic, and so forth. These people are all major donors to Contributor. Also, Stephen Colbert, you know, from the Colbert Report, major donor for Pacifica through the archives. Brian has done a significant job in cultivating these donors, and I think that's part of what he was discussing with you yesterday. Also, the archives, I just want to also reinforce that this project we're discussing concerning content from 1968 is highly significant and can have a great impact in connection with the distribution, digital distribution strategy that we're in the process of developing, and Brian is thinking very hard as to how to make that happen. In terms of the administration of the network, I just want to mention a couple of things. The operations collective process that I implemented more than a year ago has been going very well. I think you're seeing some of the fruits of that in the discussions that happened yesterday. We meet twice a month. We discuss substantive issues. It's a real working group. It's efficiently operated. We make decisions. We make substantive decisions. We address problems on a broad variety of topics. And as a result, there's more of a cross-fertilization of ideas and opinions. And we're also in the process of discussing how we kind of spin off from that process program directors getting together themselves on a regular schedule, as well as John Almella mentioned, the technical staff, as Verna mentioned, also possibly the new staff. We have the startup of the national elections and the national election supervisor on board. You've just heard that. And we have completed a round of briefings at stations by the HR director and legal counsel on harassment policy and a number of other issues. And we're about to set in motion, as soon as John Kriegler feels the timing is right, a series of briefings around at the stations regarding FCC rulings on obscenity and other issues. I want to talk about access a little bit, disability access. Unfortunately, due to illness, our consultant, Francie Moeller, is not able to be here with us this weekend. She's in the process of trying to complete the final reports. I have not really seen the draft reports from the additional stations. I have, however, met with her. I want to discuss one case study and mention also to you that the goal here is to do as much as possible, what is readily achievable, and then to plan down the road how to continue these improvements. We're beginning to implement that process now. It's part of the budget process at the various stations. Contractors are being contacted. In my report, I give you some details about the high-priority items that can be dealt with at individual stations. I just want to focus for a moment again on Houston, since I just came from there, we had a meeting there between a member. Let me do something else first. I just want to play a clip from something. John, is that the beginning of the? We need to move ahead to minute 13. Ah. I don't think this is the right part of the. No, minute 13. Well, we're having technological problems. Anyway, I had hoped to play for you another little clip. Scotty McClymans, who runs a program called Access This, which is a disability access program in Houston. don't worry about it. Did a satire on April 1st, April Fool's Day. We'll try to get you a copy of that, which was really cute. And he, you know, he did a send-up of the network, not only in relationship to disability issues, but just in relation to general policies. And it's another example of some of the talent that's out there. But let me tell you about what happened in Houston. We had a meeting with Lex Friedman, who works at Baylor College School of Medicine, at the instigation of Francie Moeller, because we wanted to solve the access problem at that station. It's a beautiful building, small building, and we need to create more space to create access on the first floor at a minimum. In order to do that, we'll need to build out a little bit, add a new room on the back of the building. But the benefit of this will not just be in terms of access for the disabled. It will help to create a technical resource center that will be accessible but also available to other sectors of the community. We hope to be able to pair up with the Houston Endowment, the Brown Foundation, Hewlett Packard possibly, Houston Centers for Independent Living, and so forth. And Lex is going to help us to consult and to promote and to broker this. And probably within the next month or so, there will be a meeting with some of these potential stakeholders and donors to look at the space as it is now. And also, Duane is beginning to work up a possible budget and work plan to begin to make that addition to the building so that we can create this new technical resource center, which will address both access problems and begin to develop a new generation of people to work with the station. It'll be a dedicated workspace, and we hope to have this done within 6 to 12 months. I reported to you already about the Democracy Now! Negotiations. We're ready to go. Also, just briefly, we have had, as a follow-up to the discussions that have happened on the board about the digital distribution project, we are in the final stages of developing a request for applications, which will then be posted publicly, and so that we'll be able to see what talent is out there within the Pacifica community to help us specifically with this project. It's a somewhat broader scope than we've reviewed, and I think it addresses some of the concerns that have been raised and also some of the very practical logistical management and practice concerns that the staff has been raising. I want to end with just a few things about recommendations. As I said to you, I think one of the key things that that the board and myself and the whole organization need to look at within the next 18 months is bylaws revision, to begin that planning process and hopefully within 2008 to initiate that. How you do that, whether you do it in an omnibus fashion or in a piecemeal fashion, is one of the decisions you will have to make. I would suggest that you look as broadly as possible at that. I've suggested also a management reorganization plan. I presented it to the board a couple of times. Ursula actually spoke to one aspect of it in her presentation today. And that will also involve, to some extent, a reorientation of the budgeting process. I think that the programming summit that we held really does represent something new. Though we may feel somewhat tentative about it. I see it as a kind of a consensus to collaborate, a willingness to explore and to exchange, which may not have been there in the recent past. It doesn't assure success, but what it does is it creates the atmosphere in which that can, the much closer collaboration and a much more open atmosphere can emerge. We'll have to follow up with the news departments, with technical, and with ongoing practice to see whether this is really going to pan out. But I'm extremely encouraged, and I would hope you are too. On the Radio for People campaign, I can't stress enough the importance of the work that Ursula has been doing, because she is our eyes and ears beyond the sister stations and is really functioning in a much broader capacity than simply the affiliates coordinator. And the significance of this filing window and what it may mean for the future of radio should not be underestimated. This will potentially allow Pacifica to be, again, a leader in community media movement. And I think we're now talking about how to develop institutional support, how to get promotion for this idea, and to organize as many groups as possible. Over the next year, I think we've begun to discuss with some of the national staff some priorities that will play a part in developing the budgets. In the area of programming, obviously communication, developing more coherent and defined processes, accentuating inclusion, and also developing beyond what we program for now, programming that focuses on documentaries, investigation, and much more dialogue. And to basically to codify this new collaborative programming initiative that we've begun. In the area of outreach, coordinating and making more effective The sort of the somewhat fragmented outreach that we do now, and increasing our marketing. You've seen the new brochure. There are also new T-shirts. This is just the start of that process. We are, in a sense, rebuilding at this moment, and this is also a this has budgetary implications. We don't know how that will pan out completely. The problem being that things like technology development, outreach, marketing, though obviously extremely important, often do not rise to the top when we are setting budget priorities, and we'll have to think hard about what the consequences of that are and how to rebalance things so that we do this much more effectively. In the technical area, we're focusing, hopefully in the next year, on increasing e-commerce, expanding streaming capacity, and the new internet platforms that you've been hearing about. In the archives area, there's the 68 Project, there's major donor development, and the acceleration, hopefully, of the preservation effort generally. I think finally, just to sort of finish, I think we have to address, and Lonnie will get into this more, a number of long-term sustainability issues. We've heard before the trends in listenership, the pressure on finances. And sometimes we get good news, you know, in the short term, but we do have a long-term view that we need to look at. The strategic planning effort that you're involved in is part of that, but we also have to take a long, hard look at the financial picture beyond 1 to 2 years. And also, as Casey has said, to improve the election process. And finally, I just want to say that I continue in the effort to encourage both more civil dialogue within this organization, both internally in what we do as people on boards and committees and stations, and also nationwide, to project that image and to project that sense of constructive, dynamic dialogue and disagreement, and show by doing that that we are ready to reframe the debate in this country.
Thank you, and it's open for questions. We don't have all that much time, but in general, people ask the questions they want to ask. Bob.
Greg, I want to follow up on some prior discussions we've had at the board meetings on the question of affirmative action in hiring. And I also would like to ask Dan Siegel to comment on what I'm asking, because you've often said that there are legal issues involved. And what I want to know is, it's beyond just the question of collecting data on the race and gender of job applicants and job holders, but also the question of, I mean, affirmative action is a very comprehensive set of policies that includes making sincere and full efforts to recruit a very diverse pool of applicants.
Sure.
And also to maintain opportunities for promotion within Pacifica of people, that encourages the people who have been historically underrepresented to be promoted. And many other things, training and so forth. And this board adopted a policy, or our predecessor board adopted this policy 4.5 years ago. So my question is, what steps have you taken to make sure that not only permanent jobs, but also short-term jobs, except in obvious cases where there's a kind of an extremely rapid timetable because of a deadline facing you, but short of that, what steps have you taken to make sure that there's a genuine broad outreach for every paid position that's available in this foundation?
Well,
and then if Dan can comment.
Yeah, I mean, I think that some of this is our questions. The question about how you know who is part of the organization, that's a complicated legal question. I've discussed it with Dan. I've communicated with you about it. There are privacy issues, and and the issue of voluntary disclosure comes into play. In terms of how the network is staffed, just generally, one way you can look at it is that in terms of the people that I am involved with directly, you know, of hiring, there are about 22 people that I have direct supervision of and hiring relationships with, and of those people, 9 are white, and the remainder of the 22 are people of color of different nationalities. Concerning the bigger question, however, that you're asking, which is a question about short-term consultancies, contracts, and that kind of thing, that I think is one of the most difficult things to resolve. I think that the posting of some of these jobs, for example, the digital distribution job that's coming up right now, and some other of the consultancies that occur, are part of the solution to that problem. But there's a balance there. There's a balance between that and the fact that you have some positions which are either so specialized in nature, so short-term in nature, or that there are people who have a historic or ongoing relationship with a specific area of the network, where if you post every job, you will be basically posting jobs and apply and reviewing applications most of the time. And there comes a point where you have to, I think, give a grant of at least some trust and discretion to the staff. And this is just not a question of my hiring or my hiring practices. I've sent a message by who I have hired. I can point to the two general managers who I have hired, two of the main hires that I've made in the last year, as evidence of that. And I will continue to try to set that example. But I don't think that the solution to the problem is to post every job, because I think that that becomes, at a certain point on certain jobs, it makes the organization somewhat unmanageable. So I don't know that my answer is going to totally satisfy you, but I do think it's a balancing act, and I do think that Dan could add to the answer in terms of what some of the limitations are on the information that you can obtain relating who is hired within the organization.
Well, I was also asking Dan about the responsibilities for affirmative action in the hiring process. Not, we've discussed the data issue a lot. I'm more concerned about the FCC has very specific rules about you have to advertise it in a whole set of places and so forth.
Well, I mean, let me mention one thing before I turn over to Dan. The one hire that I have that relates to this is the hire of the network programming coordinator. That hire was advertised very broadly. I don't have a full list of publications, but it was a lot of publications. It was advertised over a long period of time. And we did discover the race and ethnicity, you know, because of voluntary disclosure. And we had quite a diverse pool, both in the initial pool of over 30 and in the final stages of the interview process. And so, as it turned out, we hired Nathan, who is white. But there was a real effort to recruit very broadly. Also, the process is important, and as we often say, the process is one of the key ingredients here. And the process for that hire was to establish a search committee, which consisted of people from various sectors, in one case elected by one of the committees, to vest that committee with broad authority to allow them to establish the criteria, to winnow the pool, to do the interviews, and in a sense to keep meeting until they developed a consensus. It's not just about the result, as you and others have pointed out to me. It's also about the process.
Dan, did you want to comment?
Well, I've been asked to. I'm not exactly sure what the question is, but I'll give it a try. Pacifica, as an organization, has a very strong commitment to diversity, to equity, and to affirmative action. And the way that issue has often been posed in recent years is there any legal obstacle to the fulfillment of Pacifica's commitment? And I believe that there is not. We live in a society where a lot of public opinion has been shaped by measures such as those passed in the state of Michigan, the state of California, which quote-unquote outlaw affirmative action. But those measures don't apply to Pacifica. They apply to the hiring in those states by public organizations, or in some cases by companies that do business with public organizations. We are free under the law to engage in affirmative action, and again, we have a policy that requires it. And certainly there are many ways to accomplish that policy, which also, by the way, is a condition of our license. So the idea of doing broad outreach, of selecting a pool of people to interview enough people so that without asking people to fill out questionnaires, you can tell who you're interviewing, and without asking them what their ethnic background is, you can make informed judgments about that. So I think your question, Bob, is whether I believe that there is an incentive and indeed a requirement for Pacifica to engage in affirmative action and to ensure that our workforce at all levels is diverse. That's true, and again, there's no obstacle to it, and there's many measures that can be taken to accomplish it.
Was that fully responsive to your question, Bob?
Well, partly. I mean, we don't necessarily have to go into it now, but there's some very detailed FCC guidelines for equal opportunity employment that talk about the type of venues and so on. But I would recommend the Personnel Committee take this up. I'm very troubled by Greg's comment that some hires don't need to be advertised because people are too busy with other work. To me, that's the core of equal opportunity, is that it not just be a group of insiders who know the system and they have the chance.
Lisa?
I wanted to just piggyback off some of the things that Bob was asking and talk about or ask a question about the procedures for posting, because when I hear posting, I might assume that one thing has happened, so I just want to know, because I've heard some comments in which I believe I've heard some people say that they didn't see certain things. And so I just wanted to know if you could talk about the procedures when we say posting, exactly what that is, where it gets posted to. And then also I've heard a couple of comments about, I mean, there might be some, you might have the short-term jobs, but then you have some things that might not be necessarily long-term, but that are ongoing, like when we have people chosen to stream certain things or even to participate, like in these meetings on the technical aspect. So I would just like to know if you could comment on that procedure and process.
Sure. Well, a couple of things related to that. In terms of any kind of job that is, whether it's an interim job or a permanent job, if it's a staff position, the HR director is really sort of the person who directs that process, and she identifies a list of publications and out both print and online that are that are broad and appropriate. I don't have the list, but I've seen lists, and it's usually between 6 and 12 different publications and sources. Some of it we pay for, for posted ads, and some of it is free, as well as on our own website. But that's not the only part that's done. And so the other part of the question having to do with the streaming of meetings, there hasn't been to date any extra expense for that. What we had, John Elmella, who's a member of the staff, is responsible for most of the streaming. The other person who's done it over the years is Otis McClay, who's actually never been paid. And so he's basically just been a volunteer. Now, we could, try to diversify that as well on the volunteer level, provide more opportunities for other people, and we are actually trying to do that. But that's not actually a job. That was basically a donation.
When they do these meetings as well, when you have technical people doing, when I say stream, I was including like when they do these meetings and they.
Yeah. Yeah, right, I mean, you can see who's here. And
but I was just, asking about process for that as well in terms of.
Well, to be honest with you about that Otis and John had been doing this for quite some time, and Otis was a volunteer doing it. And Reeve Katsuta. I didn't know that, but it was probably before I came here. But mostly, a lot of it is actually donated time, although John is on staff. And we don't actually have much of a budget for that sort of thing, so it's not like we actually have money to spend, extra money to spend on streaming.
AC, then Thomas, then Bertolt, and that's probably going to do it for the time we have. AC?
Yeah, the question that I'm interested in, as well as the ones that have been discussed, is what is the policy towards making sure that affirmative action sticks? That is to say that once you hire a person, whether it's female or person of color, whether or not you ensure that that person is receiving a great deal of help in case they need to, either because there's extra training that has to be there, or there should be a process that would guarantee it's not enough, in other words, to hire a person, because I've seen a situation where I was at a university where they admit people, but then they got rid of them just about as fast. So my point is that what kind of policy, if you don't have it now, that you're planning to get, that would retain the person?
I'm very glad you asked that question, because you have an HR department of one person to basically deal with all of the human resource needs of approximately 300 employees and other people as well. I mean, the HR director is really responsible for any issues that that come up with the unpaid staff as well. Obviously, that's a pretty tall order for someone. And in fact, there really is no actual budget for those activities. So, for example, if we want to provide training either for the board or for staff, this comes out of a general national budget. We have line items for travel. We have a kind of sort of general line item for training. But there is no specific, it has never been addressed, at least not in the last 2 years, in the budget process, that we should have a training component. And actually, this applies both to, you know, the issue of affirmative action, but just training in general for staff. And also, potentially, as part of the affiliates program, there is the issue of training for that affiliates program, affiliates members would actually like as well. So the whole issue of training within Pacifica is pretty much an unaddressed need. We are dealing now, for example, with individual requests from either an LSB or for staff for a training program to be brought into a station. And so at this point, it's really on a case-by-case basis. Well, I will then ask Yolanda to, you know, research who's available in that area to do it. And then we'll go and we'll talk with Lonnie about, well, do we actually have money? And in a sense, HR is competing with other needs within the network and within the national organization right now, because there isn't any defined HR. There's an HR director, but in a sense what I'm saying to you is that there's not an HR office where it has an allocation of resources to do the things you're talking about, and I think that's a problem. I agree.
Thomas? Could you speak on the mic, Thomas?
I'm sorry. I apologize. Two quick questions, Greg. First of all, out of your presentation, I'm inspired to ask whether Pacifica is ready for a public relations person who does nothing but public relations, and if so, what sort of budget would you just off the top think we ought to put there? That's question number one. Don't forget that.
Lonnie's going to hate me when I...
Well, skip Lonnie. I'm talking to you. And then number two, in terms of the building unity of the network, helping the network to coalesce better. I've noticed that some of our websites don't have effective links from their station to the other stations.
Yeah.
And those who do, it's commendable, but I really think that both the Pacifica website and the stations with those links to the other websites, they should make them bigger, particularly the Pacifica one. Everyone should be big. And I don't mean so big that it's gaudy, but I think it should be more effective. We don't promote the network and don't promote coalescence of the radio stations to be a network on our website. So if you can remember those two issues.
Well, okay. Let me put the context. I mean, this is Lonnie will repeat this to some extent, but even if you, everything, all things being equal within Pacifica, the expense of running this organization will increase every year by at least $600,000 or $700,000 minimum. And Lonnie will describe some of the other factors. So I can throw out a number. In fact, we have actually discussed what it would cost as part of the national sort of budget planning group that we've kind of just put together. What it might cost to really effectively launch a PR front, you know, an outreach, you know, outreach and develop marketing campaign. And we're looking at, we're not even talking about a person at this point, although a part-time person might help, but, you know, we would still need at least probably $30,000, as I believe the number that we discussed, to begin to do this effectively. I don't know that it ends there, but it would start there. And I don't remember the details of that, but we discussed some of the components of what that funding was would be for. In terms of web development, you know, all the different the organization of IT functions is really just starting. Again, you had up until very recently, you had one person nationally to deal with all of the issues of internet without the throughout the entire network. When this area is growing in complexity every day, you also do have, at some stations, very good IT people. It's not, the resources and the skill levels differ, and you don't have real formal coordination of those websites at this point. The e-commerce comment I made is related to that, because we're hoping to establish a kind of a national e-commerce platform, and I think part of that is linking. We are beginning to more effectively link the stations to the network, but linking the stations to the stations has not occurred. And I am actually as frustrated as anyone with the lag time and the posting of certain things and the time it's taken to get some of even the existing infrastructure up. But on the other side of the equation, again, this is an area where when the budget process comes down, the budgets are really developed. Maybe you understand this, but just look, the way the budget is developed is that primarily you have two tracks. You have the station budgets that are being developed by in conjunction with the LSBs and the station managers, business managers, working with Lonnie and working with me. The national budget is almost a very theoretical construct until we know what the station budgets are going to be, because what we have to work with is dependent upon what they project to be their income and revenue, because we are a percentage of that. So we can't even really, with any accuracy, estimate what we want to budget until relatively late in the process. And so then we're down to all these unmet needs, a laundry list of things that we actually develop early on and cost out and say, okay, well, this stuff that we think we need to do costs $1 million in additional funding. Okay, how much money in July or August, when the process is finally well advanced, do we actually have to work with? And then we start cutting and cutting. And frankly, you know, what gets cut is sometimes marketing and technology and, you know, the cutting edge things, their R&D functions, you know, the things that don't have a constituency, perhaps, are the things that you can cut that are discretionary rather than, you know, actual overhead costs. And so that's the bind that we're in. And we're, in fact, at the beginning of this process, and I believe that some of what Lonnie's going to address very soon will actually deal with that. But it's a bit of a flaw in the budget process. Another flaw that I'm hoping to address through the management reorganization is to have more coordination between the priorities being developed nationally for the network and what's emerging from the stations to see whether they're actually congruent and they mesh. I'd like to see people like John and Pete and Nathan and Ursula involved more in looking at the station budgets as they're developed to see what it is they're planning to do, what the stations are planning to do, and how this can be coordinated better so that we're not developing, you know, seven different budgets. We're developing one budget.
Before we leave that point, Lonnie, could you please quickly explain the RFP? Well, I'll do it. We're coming before the board, Lonnie's going to talk about a request for proposals process that allows, that has as part of it three areas, one of which is outreach. And the point of that is we obviously can't fund staff positions for everything, but we can provide opportunities posted broadly for anybody to apply for projects that they want to execute that serve these various needs. And it allows for a funding mechanism that's definable, that has scope equivalent to the amount of funding that's available at a given time. It doesn't necessarily induce a long-term commitment, but in the event that it's wildly successful, it can identify projects that are deserving of funding. So that's one way mechanistically of approaching the problem of so many tasks and the inability to hire staff to execute each of them. Are we done? Are we? Because I know we could spend 2 hours talking to the ED, but we are really beyond time now.
And I'd love to
now.
Talk to you.
Could I follow up?
Please finish up, and then let's
well, see. I think that the problem you're describing about the restrictions on the budget and this kind of thing, what we found out at this university that I mentioned was that a lot of the students who were coming in, a lot of the faculty, there was an argument, the same argument that we're having right now. But there is such a thing as prioritizing, you know. We are an organization that has these progressive outlooks and want to ensure that we include the general community in society. So it is, it's a question of priority. I mean, if you say you're going to put heavy funding in the five areas and you can't find the funds, you have to look for funds beyond that, then you're always going to run into a situation where you won't have the money. But if you stake out a priority in terms of what you want to develop, then you can do that from the beginning of the budget process and make sure you do have money for affirmative actions and also for retention. I maintain the retention part is important as well.
Yes, I agree. If you make it a priority and you stick to it, you know, it's possible to do it. But priorities, I think what I've seen is priorities tend to shift. And we had last year what was described by Dave, I think, is almost like, I forget if you used the word standstill budget, but anyway, we started out with very ambitious goals. We ended up being able to put a very modest additional amount of money into technology, a little bit more money into the affiliates program, and into programming. If I was setting priorities now, I would say training and technology would be the areas that I would say for new funding that I would put right at the top of my list. Now, whether that's going to end up being possible and end up at the top of the list in August and September, I can't tell you that because I don't necessarily get to decide that, as far as I know.
Okay, folks, we're going to be hearing from Lonnie shortly, so we'll be able to deal with the budgets.